Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The news focuses on the most egregious incidents of racism and sexism, but really, these things happen all around us, perpetrated by ordinary people like you, like me. It's systemic. And that got John Biewen thinking. As a white man, he wondered if he had done everything he could to help people on the receiving end of prejudice. More importantly, he started to ask if he was part of the problem. Biewen is an audio documentarian, and this journey of self-discovery led to a podcast series, Seen on Radio. That's S-C-E-N-E. And last year, it focused on the problems of racism in America and the faulty logic that led to the construct of race in the first place. It was called Seeing White. This season is simply titled Men. It's about the bad and the good of masculinity and how sexism is so widespread that it affects both genders. So this hour we hear from John Biewen, program director at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University and host of the Seen on Radio podcasts. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
We're also joined by Celeste Headley, journalist, author, and speaker, and co-host of Seen on Radio's Men podcast with John, and she joins us from Washington. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Lisa Wade is with us to give us some additional perspective, although it's very early where she is. She's in Los Angeles, and she's an associate professor of sociology at Occidental College and co-author of the best-selling textbook, Gender, Ideas, Interactions, Institutions. Thanks for getting up. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
John, let me start with you. You started with this 14-part series on racism, and you're turning now to this new series on sexism. Given the ubiquitous nature of both, I'd be surprised if there weren't several podcasts dedicated to some aspect of these topics, but probably not to the degree that you've focused on them or in the way that you've focused on them. So what makes your podcasts unique?
Well, I think we've tried to approach both of these issues in a couple of ways. One is, as you said, most of the coverage, and I dare say this is true even in the more thoughtful branches of the media, such as public radio, which I worked in for many years, mm-hmm. is that we sort of focus on, when we talk about race, we're sort of looking at the experience of people of color. What's it like to, you know, oh, here's this issue that has come up, and how are the Black people or Native Americans or Latino folks faring in the face of this alleged discrimination, for example. And when we talk about sexism, it's often termed as women's issues. We're going to talk about the women's issue of sexism. And in both these cases, it's a little bizarre when you think about it, because white folks are the source and the inventors of racism and white supremacy, and men are the source of sexism. So in both of these cases, one of the things that we did with both of these series was to basically sort of say, we're going to turn the lens.
Yeah.
We're going to look at white folks, and in the second series, we're going to look at patriarchy by looking at, by sort of putting men and masculinity under the microscope.
Because as I was reading about this yesterday, it did strike me that in the programs that we have done over the years on both of these topics, we generally bring in African Americans to talk
yes.
about racism, and we bring in women to talk about the problems of sexism. And they're not the perpetrators; they're the victims.
That's right. And the other way, I think what we try to do that was different was so much of the coverage in the media is reactive. It's sort of about here's the latest incident. Somebody said something that is deemed to be racist, and so now we're gonna try to figure out if this person is a racist. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of, you know, here's the latest allegation of sexual harassment or sexual assault, and we're going to react to that. And basically what we tried to do with these two series was to first actually to go deep into history to start with and to say, how did we even get these notions, right? Where did the very idea of being white and being Black and so on come from? These have not always been present in human history. Who invented these ideas, and how have they functioned through history? And similarly then with with patriarchy and male dominance.
Both you, John, and your co-host, Celeste Headlee, have spent much of your careers in public radio and in news. You worked on producing long-form documentaries for American Radio Works, and Celeste has hosted all kinds of programs in public radio, including The Takeaway and Tell Me More and Talk of the Nation, All Things Considered. Spent some time right down the street from us at Georgia Public Radio. Talk to me, the two of you, about why podcasts, this new world of podcasting, why this seems to be the place now to do the kind of work that you're doing as opposed to putting it on the radio. Celeste, I'll start with you there.
There are a number of, first, I want to say that statistically speaking, terrestrial radio is still king.
Yes, I know.
It far outstrips the combined listenership for podcasts. So there's that. But there are some benefits to podcasting. One, of course, is that you don't have to fit into a clock. I don't have to make sure that my report is 3.5 minutes long so that we get to it before a break. You can swear in podcasts.
Wait a minute, let me write that down.
Another important thing to remember is that podcasts can be evergreen in a way that terrestrial radio can't, right? People will go back to a podcast that's a couple years old, and I think John will be able to speak to the fact that people keep going back and rediscovering the series Unseeing White as though it were new, and it is new to them. And people don't go back and listen to last year's episode of Morning Edition, right? That's for that moment. So there's a number of things that podcasts can do that terrestrial radio can't, even though terrestrial radio, again, still by far dominant.
But the restrictions that radio puts on you in terms of time and you have to write in a certain way that people get it the first time because they can't rewind and go back
right.
And listen again. When you take those restrictions away, do you have a tendency to get lazy? You have all this time in the world now, so you don't have to be as cogent. Is that a temptation that you have to fight?
I'm sure it is. John, you edited. Did you get lazy?
I hope not. I hope not. And you know, I hope that, you know, after a couple of decades in public radio and with very good editors, even when I was doing long-form, hour-long documentaries, which I've done a lot of for radio, they were always pretty, you know, it was just a whole lot more information, but it was always pretty tightly edited and not. And yes, I do think there's a tendency in podcasting, and maybe it's particularly for people who don't have that sort of background. And there are a lot of podcasts where you start into the podcast and it's 10 minutes of kind of throat clearing and talking about the weather and what did I do this weekend and what.
Yeah.
But that's not what we do on Scene on Radio.
So we want to spend some time this hour talking about both of these podcasts, Seeing White and Men, both of the Scene on Radio podcast series. Did I get your story correctly, John, about the impetus for wanting to look into racism in the first place?
Well, and basically, so I've been reporting on race in a variety of ways for decades, but I think, I say this in the first episode of Seeing White, there was sort of a growing sense in my mind of, I was feeling, in a way, the culture sort of turning its gaze at white folks and white people in a new way. And I would say start with the death of Trayvon Martin in 2012, Michael Brown in 2014, and then the series of at least publicized police shootings of unarmed black people over those next couple of years and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, things like Dylann Roof, white supremacist terrorist massacre in South Carolina, just things in the culture that were bubbling up that people were talking about, like Oscar's So White and, Macklemore getting the Grammy over Kendrick Lamar that felt like affirmative action for white people. And so that I was getting this growing sense. And then, of course, the 2016 election, and I was starting to think about this probably around the end of 2015, early 2016, and the Trumpism and this kind of raw form of white identity politics that we hadn't seen in recent years coming to the fore. And I just was started to think about what if we were to do a deep dive into race that really looked at it through the prism of whiteness.
And part of this was, as I understood it, that you wanted to make sure that you were not part of the problem. Doing a little self-examination in private is one thing, but doing it in a forum like a podcast, you're laying the cards on the table in front of anybody who wants to watch or listen in this case. The start, and both of these are touchy subjects. They're not easy to talk about, particularly for white people and for men, because these are about racism and sexism. Did this give you pause at all?
Well, it is a risky thing, and it wasn't. There wasn't a tremendous amount of individual navel gazing on my part, although the way that I framed both series was to very clearly put myself in the frame, in the sense of saying that it's important and it's significant that that it's inescapable, and it's part of the kinds of examinations that we're doing here, that I'm a white male and I'm a cisgender heterosexual white male, which is all important, especially when you're looking at gender and patriarchy. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't good. I wasn't gonna try to stand outside the frame and be this neutral journalist voice that nobody would buy that for one thing. Mm-hmm. And that the kind of examination we were going to be doing in that sort of examination, it was significant. So I was just kind of owning up to that.
So let me bring Lisa Wade into the conversation. She got up early in the morning in Los Angeles, sitting there waiting to come on the radio here. Assistant professor of sociology at Occidental College and a guest on one of your podcasts, at least one of your podcasts. Lisa, there's a song in a Broadway musical called Avenue Q in which one of the puppet characters sings, "Everyone's a little bit racist." Is that true?
Oh, of course. we all have senses, eyes and ears, and we grew up in a culture that has all kinds of sexist and racist messages, and those things go into our brains. And there's, our brain is absolutely extraordinary at absorbing information, but it's a terrible judge of material. And so we just become part of our societies, and if our societies are sexist and racist, then that's a part of us. And the important thing from there, once we understand that, is to recognize that, clearing our mind of ideas that we don't like is a lifelong project and something that requires constant reflection. So the sexism and racism tend to be sort of implicit and automatic thinking, and to challenge them in our own heads, we have to do a lot of very explicit and conscious thinking.
Here's a more difficult question, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. If everybody's a little bit racist, is everybody a little bit sexist?
Of course, because
even women?
Oh, of course, yes. And people of color are racist as well. It's just part of how we learn to get along in our societies.
Do these flashes of racism and sexism tend to come from one side? I mean, you just said that everybody's racist, including black people. Everybody's sexist, including women. But do they tend to come from one side more than the other?
I think some people are more motivated to do the explicit and conscious thinking, to do the work to challenge assumptions about who is superior and who's inferior. And so that's one of the reasons that we see women more concerned about sexism in general and the people of color more concerned about racism.
We're going to explore both of these topics with the people who explored them in this podcast series called Seeing White and another one called Men. It's all part of the Scene on Radio podcast. That's S-C-E-N-E, by the way. It's a visual thing. And we're going to come back with more with John Bewin, Celeste Headley, and Lisa Wade in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with John Bewin. Spent a long time in public radio. He's now audio program director for the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, where he joins us this morning. He, along with his co-host Celeste Headley, who's also a journalist and an author and speaker, have worked together on this podcast called Men. Previously, John worked on Seeing White, all part of the Scene on Radio podcast. And Lisa Wade joins us as well. She's an associate professor of sociology at Occidental College and an expert on these fields of racism and sexism particularly. Racism stems from America's original sin, slavery. Is that what makes this a touchy subject? And was talking about this in the way that you explored racism in America more precarious to you personally, John, than the investigation of sexism, or was it the other way around?
I don't know. I don't know if I even have an answer for that, which one was one feeling kind of more sensitive than the other. I would say they're equally loaded. And also, you know, there was a sense in which, actually the Seeing White, so that came first, and that came out in 2017. And I hadn't decided what the next series was going to be until after we wrapped up Seeing White, and I'd been thinking about some other ideas, and actually the idea of then turning to a project on sexism and patriarchy was one of the possibilities. But then, you know, what happened was the fall of 2017 and the Harvey Weinstein allegations and the kind of series of things that launched sort of the relaunch of the Me Too movement, and that's when I decided, okay, this is so. There was an element of them being timely as well. That was part of the reason.
Lisa, both of these things, racism and sexism, are kind of baked in to the culture. It's systemic, and they've been around forever. Literally forever in many cases. Racism probably is younger than the patriarchy, which has gone back millennia. But we're just now beginning to talk about this. If we'd done this, we couldn't have had this conversation 10 or 20 years ago, I don't think, because most of us would not have been aware of this. What's driving the awakening?
Oh, dear. I have a hard time agreeing with you there.
Okay.
People have been talking about racism and sexism, I would guess from their inception, and certainly.
Well, let me reframe it. Let me rephrase it. I think you're right about it. We've been talking about racism for a long time, but most people don't think of what their participation in that may be. They don't necessarily see that the reasons for people making racist comments, or even that they have made them themselves.
Well, I think it's probably true that there are waves of interest in these topics, and we have more and less active conversations in our society about these types of inequalities, and that right now we really are seeing a particularly active discussion about sexism and its impact on both men and women, and particularly how gender interacts with other kinds of identities like race, shaping people's experiences in really different ways.
Because if something's been around for a long time and we've been in the middle of it all, we don't recognize the forest for the trees. And one of the things that the Duke University Chronicle said about this first podcast series, John, was that you dug deep into the causes of white supremacy rather than looking at the symptoms. If you agree with that, explain it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that was what we tried to do with both of these, was to say instead of yes. So let me try to answer your question directly. Yeah, so we looked at the way that the very idea of distinct human races came about, because that idea is only, roughly 500 years old, and 500 or 600 years old, and really got further refined in colonial America and early America. So things that we live with every day, notions of people being black and white, and then, you know, there have been these variety of quote-unquote scientific classifications of people since the scientific revolution that classified people into 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 races, and there's never been any consensus because, in fact, there's no genetic or biological basis for dividing people in this way. But we really told the story of how that got invented. And just to, you know, for example, that apparently a guy writing a book in Portugal in the 1450s, according to one scholar who looked deeply into all of that history, seems to be the first person to have sort of lumped all the people of Africa together into one group and called them, you know, black people who are going to declare them to be inferior beasts. And it happened to be, of course, at the very time that the slave trade, which had been going sort of in all directions, people enslaving all kinds of people, that Europeans were going to start focusing primarily on sub-Saharan Africa as their source of kidnapped and free labor. And so to justify that, we're going to declare black people to be inferior, despite the fact that some of the most advanced cultures in the world at the time were in North and West Africa.
And in the course of doing this podcast, this first series, I understand what you wanted to do is talk to non-overtly racist white people. Did you find them? Were they hard to find? Were they willing to talk?
Well, it's more the issue is, you know, as you said, so a lot of the time, you know, and you've alluded to people making racist comments and that kind of thing. So much of the discussion tends to be about that racism and white supremacy is the problem of a few avowed racists. You know, it's the KKK and the neo-Nazis. And the rest of us are basically innocent, and it's a matter of sort of identifying those few people who are the racists. And the fundamental thing that we did with both of these series is to say, no, we're talking about systems. And this picks up on what Lisa was talking about, that these are deeply embedded in the very structure of our society and in our culture. And so a lot of it, and this is, it works kind of ingeniously that especially those of us are at the top of these hierarchies are deeply trained by our culture not to see them and to see them as normal and natural. It's normal and natural that white men are at the top. And anything that, you know, and any break from that, we tend to first, we might be threatened by it or we might congratulate ourselves for it. But that sort of seems normal and natural. So a lot of what we were doing with these series was to sort of help all of us get better at seeing these things, this water that we're swimming in.
And Celeste Headley, you joined John Biewen in the second series, Men. Is it the same thing you're trying to accomplish there, an exploration of non-overtly sexist males?
Well, that wasn't my aim. I know lots of non-overtly sexist males, although I will say this, that some of the most dangerous, as a female, the biggest obstacles for me are often the progressive males who don't think they're sexist. Mm. So the reason being that somebody's openly sexist, they're easy to identify. You see them right away, and you know to watch out for them. When a guy doesn't believe that he's sexist, and of course he is, because that's the waters in which we all swim, as John was saying. It's really difficult to point out the decisions that they make or the assumptions that they make that are based on sexist culture and history. Those are the hardest to get by because they so resist any idea that they might be making decisions based on gender. My goal in participating in the podcast wasn't to find those people. My goal was, I thought, hey, here's a man actually willing to talk about sexism when generally they run and hide as soon as you use the word feminist or sexist. So that was a rare opportunity for me, and I thought, hey, maybe we might actually be able to reach some kind of honest conclusion if a man's willing to own up to his own sexism, even as a progressive, small p, male.
You, Celeste, at one point in your career worked at The Takeaway. That was a high-profile program carried by NPR and on this station. that I know Adam had a problem with sexism. The other high-profile NPR show was On Point, also a problem, both in terms of the hosts being accused of sexual harassment and misconduct and
don't forget and Prairie Home Companion.
I'm sorry, and Prairie Home Companion, yes, indeed. All of the hosts involved there were accused of similar misconduct. There were differences, but similarities as well. So two questions for you about that. How bad was that experience for you and some of the people that you worked with there, and what role did that play in your saying yes to co-hosting this podcast?
That was the worst professional experience of my life. It was the kind of experience that scars you. I lasted longer with my co-host, John Hockenberry, than any other female in the history of broadcasting. So clearly I stayed too long. But it almost kept me from being the co-host of this show because, frankly, when John called me, it wasn't all that long after those revelations had been made public in the paper, and I was one of the very first women to choose to break her non-disclosure agreement, and I actually convinced others to break their NDAs as well in order to make that story public. And so I had thought that the reason John was calling me was so that I could bear my pain in the podcast in order to get more listeners. That was my first initial reaction, and I was a little bit suspicious. But frankly, then I went back and listened to the season called Seeing White, and it became clear immediately that that's not what he was looking for. Seeing White is a true and very painfully honest exploration, not just of racism in general, but of the places in which John himself has made assumptions based on race. Mm. And so I had a good inkling that perhaps that might be what this season was as well.
There's a lot of hidden pain out there in terms of both racism and sexism, Lisa. It seems to me that people haven't really talked about it. They haven't come forward. When they do, it's often painful. We watched that in the Kavanaugh hearings, a very painful experience for Blasey Ford. Is listening to something like these podcasts, is this something that makes people feel that they are less alone, number one? Number two, is it something that if you are a unknowing, unwitting perpetrator of these things, racism and sexism, that your eyes might be open, that this is a safe way to examine your own activities and actions?
I think that we have to believe that talking about these things matters. I do believe that hearing other people having similar experiences is incredibly valuable for building coalitions. And because sexism and racism are social problems, they have to have social solutions. We can never fix them in our own lives as individuals. So coming together, seeing that we have common interests, being able to articulate and frame them in ways that bring us together is everything. It's the only way we ever change these things for the better.
John has said that patriarchy is bad for everybody, and we live in a patriarchy, and we have for millennia. What do you see, Lisa, as the impact of that over time, particularly in the modern culture?
Yes, so sexism and racism, they persist because they evolve. And we're in a really interesting moment right now in terms of gender, where men often don't feel particularly free or powerful. And so it can be very confusing to listen to feminists talk about these things. And I think that the reason is because sexism right now is operating on two tracks. On the one hand, there's prejudice against people with female bodies, women. Everyone's familiar with that idea. That's actually been on the decline since the 1970s. It's still around, but not as virulently as it was then. The other kind is sexism against anyone that does femininity. So that includes cis women who are required to do some femininity, but also trans women and any men who seem feminine. All of those people are also experienced prejudice against them because we don't value femininity. And what that means is that individual women in America today have an extraordinary amount of freedom even compared to men today. And that's because we require them to do some femininity, but we also kind of think they're cool when they do some masculinity. So women get to craft these identities and lifestyles that incorporate things from both sides. And that's really freeing for women. And I think a lot of women in many ways feel very free today. Mm-hmm. Because femininity is devalued, though, men don't feel as free to mix femininity into their personalities. So they experience more constrained lifestyles, but the things they're constrained into are valued. So they're constrained into masculinity, and that's where the respect and the esteem and the money is. So in a way, in America today, women are more free, but men have more power. And it's very confusing, I think.
Wow. That's the downside, I guess, of patriarchy for men, the fact that they're tied up by their own construct of being superior. This idea of not valuing femininity, is that because we view it as weak? The men are strong, women are weak, they're the fairer sex, they need protection. And if that's the case, didn't men invent that?
Well, I think it is, in all cases, elites and elite men invented that idea. And this idea actually is, you can trace it just back to the Victorian era, just a couple hundred years old. The particular gender stereotypes we live with just evolved out of industrialization and people in America moving to cities. And in cities where people lived in homes and then went out to work, this idea of going to work versus staying home is invented really around 1900. And those, we call them separate spheres, become gendered, and we have this idea then of women staying home and, quote-unquote, you know, not working, even though they're doing all kinds of labor in the home, and then men going out to work and doing all the valuable stuff, right? And that's the origin of the gender stereotypes we have today. Before that, everybody understood that women were working and working hard, you know, churning butter and helping raise animals and doing laundry before laundry machines was not nothing, not working. And so we can, again, just like with race, we can trace this back to really recent developments.
But not all societies are patriarchal. There are examples of societies through history that are not. When we come back, I'm just curious if you explored how we got here, why we adopted this. And why not the other way around? We'll come back and talk about that with John Biewen and Celeste Headley, who co-host the Scene on Radio podcast Men, and Lisa Wade, Associate Professor of Sociology at Occidental College. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Scene on Radio is a podcast series. They first tackled racism in a series called Seeing White. It's still available, but it was first produced in 2017. The latest is called Men. It is co-hosted by our two guests this morning, John Biewen, who's an audio program director at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, and Celeste Headley, who has hosted a number of programs on public radio and national public radio over the years. She's the co-host of Men. And we're also joined by Lisa Wade, Associate Professor of Sociology at Occidental College. We were talking about sexism and the patriarchy, and not all societies through history have been run by men. Some have had very powerful women at the fore, and women took an equal share in making decisions. That has not been the case necessarily in Western society, although women are probably the real powers behind many thrones, so to speak. When you explored the roots of patriarchy, did you discover why men took the lead in Western society?
Shall I take this one?
Sure, John.
Really the consensus now among anthropologists and folks like that who've tried to tease out this history is that roughly 10 or 12,000 years ago, and this is the time when people started to really settle out from hunter-gatherer groups, which were usually pretty small, you know, sort of small tribal groups, maybe picture 25 people kind of living together and figuring out a life together and roaming around and so on, and settled into more agricultural-based communities that started to get more specialized, right, and more complex. So you started to have people who not everyone was just spending all their time meeting the basic needs of hunting and gathering the food that was needed and raising the children and so on. And you started having people organized into, a sort of leadership class and a priestly class and this sort of thing. And that, according to scholars, is when men kind of seized the upper hand in terms of really power dynamics, right? That the economic and kind of political power was now going to be in the hands of men. And why? Well, it's somewhat speculative, right? I mean, part of it might have been that women were in a more, oftentimes just in a more vulnerable and constrained position because women give birth and nurse babies and are pregnant and nurse, you know. But
yeah,
in
but
any
the
case,
law, the laws were set up to make sure they could not succeed on their own. For the
well,
longest
eventually,
time.
Eventually, yes, and that this would get codified into law, absolutely, and it certainly into American history, mm-hmm. and in some ways still today, but yes, initially, apparently, it was a sort of a cultural thing.
The same is true of racism, particularly in the United States. The laws were set up so that black people could not succeed during slavery and well and right to today in many cases. A lot of the political angst I think that we're going through in this country today is that we're becoming more multicultural. We're not just a white country anymore. And what we're experiencing is these fears of the dying breaths of white male control. Is there an equivalent to that with regard to the changes in gender roles and how we view women in the workplace and what women's roles in society are as they have begun to change, Lisa?
Yeah, we can think about sexism as having a hostile and a benevolent version. And usually plan A is benevolent sexism. So it's a way of sort of being sweet and nice to women in a way that gets them to consent to inequality. And participate in it for whatever little benefits women can get from it. And in the moments when benevolent sexism doesn't work, when women say, no, this is not acceptable, that's when hostile sexism jumps in. And so the best example I can give is something most women will recognize, which is the catcaller on the street, the man who calls out to a woman and says, and he's a stranger, and he says, hey, sweetie, you have a beautiful smile, why don't you smile? Mm. And it's this expectation that women perform pleasantness for men. And if a woman smiles, okay, that's fine, good girl. But if she doesn't want to smile, then he'll often retort with a, why are you such a, and he'll use a slur.
Mm-hmm.
And so this really rapid shift from, hey, honey, you're so sweet, you're so nice, to, hey, lady, why are you so terrible? Is the plan A, plan B of benevolent and then hostile sexism.
And if I understand this correctly, one of the things that you're finding out and you're pointing out in this podcast is that although the woman is certainly hurt by that, the man who's perpetrating that action is actually in a straitjacket. He's doing that because he's been told that's the way to be a man. Am I getting this right?
Well, one of the most important things about how sexism works is that on the one hand, it arrays men and women into a hierarchy, men above women, but it also arrays men into a hierarchy all their own. So there are better men and lesser men in sexism as well. And so by threatening men with them being devalued in terms of masculinity is a way to keep men in line, keep men in that small box where they get to hoard power and wealth. But that small box that is still very uncomfortable and straining. So sure, a lot of men police themselves to obey these rules, and they police other men to obey these rules too, because if you're in a hierarchy of men, it's very threatening to fall down. And yet even when you're at the bottom, it's better to uphold patriarchy because at least you're not a woman. So it's a very complicated and nuanced experience for both men and women.
And it's also about power. Both racism and sexism are about power. And if you're in the catbird seat, giving up power is something you don't want to do, and it's certainly uncomfortable to do. How do you convince people in that position that this is not a zero-sum game, that giving up a little power, letting people have equality, whether it's gender equality or racial equality, that they're not going to lose as a result of that? Celeste.
So I don't think you ever do really convince the masses of that. If you look back through history, at least in the United States, we have never achieved civil rights victories through popular vote. It's almost always been legislation or it has been a Supreme Court decision. So in the end, you have to end up sort of making the case and doing the right thing, and then everyone and then culture generally follows along behind it. I mean, after all, it took the deadliest war in American history to end slavery. That wasn't a victory of persuasion. That was a victory of economic devastation and just pure body count. It's not a convincing thing, but I will say that it is self-rewarding. And I say that because, you know, just in my personal relationships, the issue of sexism comes up all the time. You know, we see this in marriages where men feel they are doing at least half of the work. And if you ask them, they'll say they're doing half of the work at home or even more than half. But then when that's actually studied, they're doing more than they have in past years, that's for sure. But they're not even close to half. Not even close. And so obviously in my personal relationships, I expect half. I'm working hard. I don't want to come home and be expected to always cook the dinner and do the dishes. So it comes up. And most men end up having to face this in their own personal relationships or even in their own workplaces. And let me mention the takeaway. There was a large number of my former male coworkers who, even though they had never either bullied or sexually assaulted or sexually harassed me or my female coworkers, they stood by while that was happening. And so they had to do a reckoning themselves. And I think in terms of what we're talking about is persuasion, I think those are the most persuasive events, is when someone realizes the damage that has been done to someone they care about.
I hesitate to bring politics into this discussion, but I think we should. We live in a world of Donald Trump, and I'm curious about how that has changed all of this in any way, because his running for election and his victory, a lot of elements have come out of the shadows, and perhaps the hidden character of some people has been revealed because it has been given permission to be revealed. Donald Trump, as a candidate, survived the Billy Bush bus tour and comments about the advantages fame gave him when it came to women. He's a man's man in that he always seems bruising for a fight. He even referred to, at one point, to the size of his genitalia. What has this done to any progress being made by women in their quest for equality and in some people's belief in the legitimacy of that quest, if anything, Lisa, or Celeste?
I'll tell you right now, my reaction is that it's really ticked women off in general. Not all of them. Obviously, there's mostly a slightly older white females who are very supportive of Trump regardless. But the rest of women, the past few years have just been an exercise in rage, and frankly, righteous rage. And this is something I've talked about before, that I think one of the biggest changes I've seen is that the women I know and those that I've spoken to and interviewed have stopped worrying so much about convincing men to do the right thing, because that's just not working. I think at this point they don't give a flying fig. And they're going to take it. They've realized that it will not be given. It will have to be taken. And so there is a great deal of anger. And if you look at some of not only the think pieces and the op-eds and the columns, but some of the books being released by Jessica Valenti and others, Amber Tamblyn, those books are about anger.
Rebecca
and
Traister.
And so patience has run out.
Is that what we witnessed in the midterms? Partly in the midterms, the women coming to the polls and electing women? Because if they're not going to give us power, we'll take it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lisa, you call Trump's masculinity toxic, and he's obviously not alone in his approach to that. If he's a good example of toxic masculinity, who is a good example of non-toxic masculinity?
Well, ultimately, I don't think there is a non-toxic masculinity.
Thank you. Oh, come on. How about Mr. Rogers?
Because the entire point of masculinity is to differentiate men from women. And the entire point of differentiating men from women is putting men above women. That is the function of masculinity, and it has been its function for thousands of years. And if you really want to talk about what's a good man, all you need to do is think about what's a good person. Because there's no positive quality about men that I think we'd want to say women couldn't also embody. If you strip away all the things about masculinity that we decide are toxic, whatever those things are, you get left with a core of qualities that are really wonderful. You know, courage, hardworking, loyal, all these wonderful things. And women are not that. Women are also courageous and loyal and hardworking. So I think when you actually try to think about, is there anything that is at the core of masculinity that we would feel comfortable saying that men are and women are not, I just don't think there's anything there. And so when we talk about how to be a good man, I would love it if we could just change the conversation to what do we need to do to be a good person.
We have a white man and a black woman co-hosting this show about gender and men, masculinity. Are images and expectations for masculinity substantially different, or are they the same across racial lines?
Yeah, we did an episode that went at that question, and we just for lack of being able to do everything in one episode, we chose to focus on African American men and Asian men, kind of broadly, and to as examples to sort of point out how notions of masculinity get coded differently in our culture depending on how you are identified racially and ethnically. And we looked at a lot of movie images and things like that. And also kind of traced how these things were constructed in American culture, that they didn't just emerge organically either, that they had bases in labor history, for example, and economic and political history.
And do you also explore the fluidity of gender? Because we're now beginning to understand the fluidity of sexuality. Is there a fluidity to gender that you explore?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean and Lisa can talk to this more authoritatively than I can. She's by the way, author of a textbook called Gender. Get that plug in on your behalf, Lisa.
Well, let's turn it over to Lisa. We only have a minute and a half left, so let me turn it over to Lisa for that question.
Well, a lot of young people are challenging what's called the gender binary, which is the idea that there's only two sexes, men and women, and that they are quote-unquote opposite. And so a lot of people, young people in particular, are challenging this notion, really kind of exploding this idea of the gender binary. And it's really exciting because everything we can do to undermine the notion that humans come into categories, whether gender, race, or otherwise, is really helpful for undermining inequality. Because if you don't have categories, you can't rank them.
So we have about a minute left, and I'm curious, when listeners take that deep dive with you into both of these topics that you've covered in the Scene on Radio podcasts, how do they come out? What are you hearing from people who listen?
You know, I've been really surprised and really startled, actually, but in a good way, by the responses. The number of people who've written iTunes reviews or posted on social media or sent us emails basically saying that these series have been really eye-opening, people more than I would have ever imagined have used phrases like life-changing. So I think, you know, we try to take people on a journey and to say everything that we've learned, that we glean from our culture day-to-day about these things, is a very, very incomplete and distorted picture.
John Biewen,
here's a different one.
John Biewen and Celeste Headlee are co-hosts of the Men podcast, part of the Scene on Radio series, S-C-E-N-E, available where podcasts are found. And Lisa Wade from Occidental College. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.